say one more time what absolute voting cheating is? Is it just the essence of voting cheating as opposed to aspiring voting towards?
When we think about absolute or ultimate bodhicitta, so we've got basically two types of bodhicitta, two types of absolute and relative, and then relative has two types, the aspirational and the engaged. So that's sort of the four, the tree there. So we've got relative and ultimate at the top. So both relative and ultimate bodhicitta are characterized as a focus on enlightenment, but the way we focus is different. So in relative bodhicitta, it's the wish to achieve it, like a focus on the future. The ultimate bodhicitta is looking at the nature of enlightenment right now. So what is enlightenment? So enlightenment is it's the emptiness of all phenomena. It's seeing that everything in this world comes together by causes and conditions, by interdependence. But when these things come together, we cling to them as being something, we name them, we work with them as if they are something, and to a large degree, they seem to consistently work that way in this world. But ultimately, there isn't any real lasting thing that is that entity. So everything can be like, you take it apart, and it's like a car, you know, we say, this is a car, but if you start, you take it apart and you spread it apart all across your lawn, like you'll see all over the state of Maine and New England, probably all over America. You'll see cars, you know, where the car is being taken apart. Is there a car there? There are all the parts of a car, but where is the actual car? That hulk that's sitting there cannot move because one wheel is over there, the engine's over there, the axle is who knows where. So when it's all together and working in a certain way, we say, this is a car. But that idea, this is a car that we then get attached to, and then we say, this is a good car, a bad car, and we judge it, and we have all sorts of ideas about it. Actually, in the essence of it, there's no real car that's there. And when we're talking about external things like cars, it's kind of, you know, we can understand it in a certain level. It sometimes seems kind of like, what's the big deal about this? The point is that when you realize this emptiness, the emptiness is not separate from our perception. It's not separate from the wisdom that perceives it. We're not separate from the outside world, in other words. We think of ourselves as being discrete beings, but we're not. So the emptiness, when we realize that emptiness is not just a blank void. It's not like you realize the nature of all phenomena being emptiness, and all of a sudden you yourself become like a rock or a stone, as Trungpa Rinpoche repeatedly says, and you'll read in some of the books that, I think both of the books that you're studying on Monday and Wednesday nights talk about this. You don't become like a rock when you realize Mahamudra. You don't really become like a rock when you realize emptiness. You still have a quality of knowing. So there's, even though when we look at ourselves, for example, we examine our own minds, we cannot find any substantial thing that is a real, we could say is a real mind. It's just this mash of impulses that kind of arise and that produces the illusion of a self. There's nothing really there, and once we realize that there's nothing really there, that does not stop us from perceiving the nature. We still perceive the nature, and we still perceive how it happens through interdependence in an illusory fashion. So the ultimate nature is that perceiving things, perceiving the ultimate empty nature of all phenomena. That's what we mean by ultimate bodhicitta. It has this aspect of compassion as well. I mentioned this last night. When you realize ultimate bodhicitta, you realize that other sentient beings see themselves as being separate sentient beings, see themselves as being existent individuals and therefore experience suffering, so you automatically feel compassion for them. So that empty nature of the wisdom is inseparable from the clear aspect of wisdom, and that clear aspect of wisdom has the aspect of that has the nature of compassion as well. So the emptiness and the compassion cannot be separated. You can't say this is compassion and this is emptiness. We're mixing them to an equal proportion. It's like they're just inseparable from each other. That's the ultimate bodhicitta. So in this way, you can also say, if you look at it in an even deeper level, you could say that actually ultimate relative bodhicitta, when we have the wish right now that we are going to achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings, this is a relative thought. And yet, if we look at the nature of that thought, there is no real nature there. It itself is emptiness. But it also has that aspect of clarity, of knowing, wisdom that is present. So if we realize that the nature of the relative bodhicitta is the ultimate bodhicitta as well. The expression of that ultimate bodhicitta is relative bodhicitta. These two cannot be separated in actuality, but for convenience, from our sort of short-sighted, ignorant perspective, they seem like two different things. Yes.
This might seem like just a bit of an academic question, but is the sutra requested by Sabahu not in the Pali Canon?
Probably not. I have not checked the catalog of the Pali Canon. Steve's question is the sutra requested by Subahu in the Pali Canon? And the answer is probably not. The Pali Canon is the set of sutras that the Theravada school, they were preserved, that came south from, it was transferred to Sri Lanka around the time of Ashoka in the following centuries as Buddhism spread south to Sri Lanka. And then at some point it became cut off from the northern traditions where the Mahayana later flourished. So the sutra requested by Subahu is probably a Mahayana sutra, but I don't know that for certain. I'd expect that it's probably not in the Pali Sutras because they would probably practice more bodhicitta if they had more sutras about it. And Tracy? And then we have one in the back also.
Could you explain how it is that it seems by taking the bodhisattva vow, merit flows even when we're asleep or careless?
Okay, so the question is, how is it that when we take the bodhisattva vows, the merit of this, not just it's when we have the engaged bodhicitta. So you take the bodhisattva vows, there are two levels of the bodhisattva vows. There's the aspirational and the engaged bodhisattva vow. When you have the aspirational bodhisattva vow, it doesn't necessarily flow continuously. But when you have the engaged bodhicitta, it does flow continuously. So the vow of engaged bodhicitta, it's a commitment. And that commitment is to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And in order to fulfill this commitment, it means that you are going to do the practice of the six paramitas. In a sense, the aspirational bodhicitta is you're thinking about the result. I want to achieve the result, Buddhahood. An engaged bodhicitta is thinking about the causes. So the causes are what? They are discipline. They're generosity, discipline, patience, diligence, dhyana, and prajna, these six paramitas. So once you make that commitment, you're holding the vow to actually do them. Now, a vow is something that you actually have that commitment at all times, even when you're asleep or when you are or when you're unconscious. For example, what Trang Rinpoche talks about with the vow to not kill, which is not one of the it's not directly one of the bodhisattva precepts, although it, of course, killing does violate the bodhisattva precepts, but it's part of the pratimoksha vows. When you have a vow not to kill and you're sleeping, you're still keeping your vow. But if you don't have the vow not to kill, it's like your cat is sleeping, your cat is not, killing things, but they don't have the merit of keeping the vow. But while you, if you have the vow, keep that vow of not killing, then you're also gaining the merit of keeping the vow, even though you're just lying there sleeping. Similarly, with the bodhisattva vow, when you have the engaged bodhisattva vow, you've started keeping the precepts of that actual practicing the six paramitas. And so as you are doing your, as you are sleeping and unconscious, because you are keeping that vow, you have that merit of continuing to keep the vow of engaged bodhicitta. And did you have a question? Yes.
So how would somebody with that maintain bodhisattva vows and bodhicitta while also dealing with these sentient beings that clearly want to live as well?
Yes, well, there are different types of... It's always difficult, you know. This is a very interesting question in Buddhist ethics.
The question is...
When we get ill, it's often caused by parasites or by microorganisms or so forth, which are sentient beings. And so how do we deal with illness? How do we heal our illnesses and still maintain our bodhisattva, maintain our compassion towards these sentient beings? I think it's very clear that, you know, our bodies are filled with parasites, not necessarily bad parasites, good parasites as well. And there are all sorts of microorganisms, you know, our digestive tract is filled with microorganisms. And the Buddha himself said that we have 84,000 different types of sentient beings within our bodies. And so, like, when we have an infection and we take antibiotics, it would seem that, well, in fact, and indeed, that is the goal of antibiotics, is to kill these microorganisms that are causing infection and so forth. So this is a very difficult question. And the, part of the question is figuring out at what level does an organism then become sentient? Is a single-cell bacteria sentient? Is a virus sentient? This is a difficult one I have no way of saying. For me personally, I think the important thing is to have the attitude that by doing something if I don't do something to overcome the illness, there's no way I can practice the bodhisattva path. So you have the attitude of compassion. I'm doing the steps necessary. If it involves taking an antibiotic, then you take the antibiotic with the resolve by getting over this illness, may I be able to help all sentient beings. If you have that attitude, then I think it's okay. This is, I think, there are great Buddhist masters who take antibiotics and so forth, Trungpa Rinpoche among them. And so it's a hard question. If you just say, I can't harm any of these microorganisms and therefore succumb to an infection and die, we can't benefit anyone if we haven't gained enough control over our mind either. So it's a very difficult, I can't give an easy answer to that one, but I think the main point lies in the motivation, and if we have the motivation that we're doing it to, that we're trying to heal our bodies in order to benefit beings, that's the most important. Marnie?
I kind of like to take that question a little bit farther.
Okay.
And if, let's say you have an elderly animal as a pet,
mm-hmm.
and you have done as much as possible medically to heal and ease that animal's suffering,
mm-hmm.
What is the, I don't know if the word is better, expression of bodhicitta to allow the animal to suffer and die naturally or to end the animal's suffering when you're in a terminal situation?
Ending the animal situation in a terminal situation involves killing the animal. And we don't know what's going to happen to the animal upon its death. We don't know whether that animal is going to go up or go down. If that animal is going down, then we're sending it to unbearable suffering sooner than it would otherwise go. And at the same time, we're also killing, which is a bad karmic action for ourselves. So in that, from the Buddhist perspective, the karmic perspective, and this is not the general perspective in our society, the better course is to offer as much palliative care as you can, to ease the suffering as much as you can. But actually taking the, you know, when you take the animal to the vet, you are killing. The vet is killing. The vet's assistant who's holding the animal is engaged in the process of killing and therefore accumulates the karma of killing. It's killing out of ignorance. It's not killing out of a wish to harm, but it is still killing. Yes?
If I could pick up on that. What if I were willing to suffer because of karma in order to ease the suffering of this animal's life by performing euthanasia?
Well, that's fine if you have enough realization to make it actually happen. But if you don't have the realization and to make it happen, then it's a very different matter. We have to... the question is, when is it permissible to do something that otherwise would be a violation of the bodhisattva vow? When is it permissible to do it? That you really have to examine your own self. There are times when bodhisattvas are allowed to kill. It's when they're able to do it and they're certain that it will prevent suffering, and that they're doing it completely with an attitude of compassion. So in such an instance, it's and there's no other option. That's the other thing. So the only way to prevent the suffering is by killing. And then at that point, it's permissible to do it. But reaching that level is a very high bar. It's not so easy.
Well, I wasn't so much asking if I were able to determine, but I'm willing.
You're willing to make that sacrifice?
No idea what the consequence will be.
Well, that's the problem. It's having no idea. If we don't really know what's going to happen to that, where is that animal's consciousness when parting from this life, is it going to go to a better realm? In which case, you can say, sure. Is it going to go to a worse realm? Then definitely not. But since we don't know, it's difficult to say. It's not an easy situation. Yes?
First of all, I'm so glad that I'm a part of you. So thank you. But I was wondering if you could guide on a day in my life. So I wake up in the morning, I sit, and I do my practice, and I dedicate the practice to all sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm on my way to work, and as I'm driving in my car, and I'm passing people, and perhaps saying some mantra, and as I'm passing people, I see them in their windows, and I'm wishing them happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So I get out of my car, and I try to, you know, set the stage for a great day, a wonderful day with the children, the people that I work with, and I try to train my mind in a way that I'm going to be in benefit to others.
Mm-hmm.
So through my actions and my words and how I communicate, I try to keep that motivation of just my intentions of I'm trying to benefit them, to bring them to a state of Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now, I'm not going to, okay, so I keep that intention. So, let's see, so with relative bodhicitta, I'm making the aspirations. So I'm working with them and, you know, helping them learn. But then, that part escapes me. Like, that,
yeah.
That's not part of it. I mean, I could help them through my actions of, you know, we want to work together because... we want everybody to be happy, so that's our intentions. We want, you know, when you're playing with somebody or, you know, working with somebody, we want each other to be happy. And, you know, so I can bring those aspects of practice through my work. but to to want to really bring them to the state of Buddhahood. You know, I can't talk about Buddha, I can't talk about the Dharma, in subtle ways. So my question is, what more can I do? Like, what else is there? Like, what, you know, is it just through actions and words and making aspirations for them? And for me to be able to pause and see clearly the interconnectedness and to be able to, have the understanding of interdependence, but not the, you know, the experience.
Realization, yeah.
Like, is there anything more that I can, that I'd be able to do?
I think that what you're describing all sounds actually very good. Keeping and maintaining that attitude, that wish to help, and the more intense that, or the more the greater the help that you're wishing to bring, the better. You know, the more you, instead of going beyond just ordinary altruism to bodhicitta, in your thoughts and in your actions during the day, the better. So what you're doing is excellent, and the way you're handling it is excellent. And in most school systems, you can't. You can't really say, I'm a Buddhist and you should be Buddhist too. And frankly, you know, it may not be productive. Often the best way to help people is by example. People are going to say, oh, my teacher, I think she was a Buddhist. What's Buddhism? You know? You know, you don't have to hide the fact that you're Buddhist, but you don't want to push it on anyone. And, you know, you can use some of the stories and things from Buddhism, but you know, you want to be careful about it because people are, you know, you don't want to turn anyone off. And if it creates a big problem, then that would be even worse. So it's best to continuing as you're doing is good. The only other thing to do would be to really consider the preciousness of your opportunity and keep that in mind all the time until it just becomes so unbearable that you feel like there's nothing else you can do but devote yourself entirely to practice. That takes a while to develop. But the more you can do. Actually, you know, it's often said that the Bodhisattva path is a path for householders because, you know, we monks get to go off and sit in monasteries and you all have to deal with people. So you have a wonderful opportunity to do it. So if you can use it as part of your path of not just of engaged bodhicitta, of not just of aspirational bodhicitta, but to make it into actual engaged bodhicitta, to, you know, when you give little treats to your students or something, when you see that you're giving them education, it's also a gift. When you practice patience with the people who are, doing things that are completely annoying or getting angry or whatever. Those are all, you can use those all as ways to practice the Bodhisattva path. Yes?
Just to be really clear in this, what we're talking about right now, being in our daily lives and we have the intention in the morning and through our day as was just being talked about in wanting to help beings in the best that we can, and which is bringing them to Buddhahood. But many times through the day, we may be working to be the best that we can and to be there for others in the best that we can with our clients or anyone that we engage with. But is it true that that is not real engaged bodhicitta unless we're actually thinking, may this bring them to Buddhahood? Do we actually have to, like, have that consciously in what we're doing in order for it to be really engaged bodhicitta?
With engaged bodhicitta, no. Because you've already made the commitment and you're fulfilling it. I mean, it's as it says, even when you're asleep or unconscious, You go to bed at night. If you have the vow of engaged bodhicitta and you're fulfilling it, you're still keeping that vow while you're asleep. You're still keeping that vow while you're not thinking about it. So it's more than just the aspiration. The aspiration is like, I'd like to do it. And the engaged vow is like really doing it. So the things that you do in your lifetime, and on a strict level, yes, it's not really, you don't necessarily have to keep it in mind all the time. But the more often you remind yourself, the better. It's said often 6 times per day, 3 times during the night, 3 times through the night. Sometimes it says 6 times during the day and 6 times at night. The more you remind yourself to rouse bodhicitta, the better off you are. For example, people who are in like therapy or massage or medical professions, you know, in between, in the breaks in between clients or patients, you can think bodhicitta. When you're a teacher, you know, in the 4 minutes between periods, that sounds pretty hard, but, you know, in the time between periods, you can use the moments in between seeing people to develop the attitude of bodhicitta. But once you've taken the vow, as long as you're not doing something that's going to break your vow, and we'll get to those, then it's not necessary to have it. In other words, you don't have to beat yourself up if you don't have it in mind all the time. We are ordinary individuals, but we need to train ourselves so that it comes to mind more easily, more frequently.
Can I just add one more thing to that? If we're practicing Vajrayana and we see ourselves through the day as the deity and performing actions or whatever we're doing as the deity, is that the same? Is that like...
Well, that's the... The pure view, or the pure perception, or the sacred outlook, you could call it, sacred view. That comes out of bodhicitta. It's sort of like a different way of approaching it, but it's related to bodhicitta. I think actually we are kind of running a little bit short. We've run over on time already. So since we've run over on time, what we will do now is we will... recite the Sunam Di dedication for merit, and then we will get back together at 2:00. O Sunam Di Tam Che Sipani Tob Ne Nye Pe Tranam Pam Che Ne Ke ga na chi ba la tru ba yi si pe tso le dro wa dro wa shu.